This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Okay, here we are. We're sitting down for a little bit of coffee in Shanghai, central Shanghai area, and we just visited a big mall. And there's a few of these big malls around. Got some nice photographs. And some things we noticed were interesting, but of course, our emphasis is not on this high-density, high-end retailing. James, throat's bothering him a little bit. Too much traveling, too many talks, a famous guy, talking too much, shaking too many hands.
Shaking too many hands, talking too much rubbish, and but the voice is still just about holding out. So I think that mall was really interesting that we visited the other day. It felt quite a lot like the Mitsukoshi that we shot a bit of video at as well. And I think your analogy was so perfect. As we walked in the door, you said, "This feels like an airport terminal."
Yeah.
And that's what it felt like.
Airport terminal, yeah.
A complete anonymous kind of feeling with all the brands there, nicely presented. And you kind of walk through and have that same kind of feeling of, well, you're there and you're shopping and the brands are there. And, but I think the thing that really struck me in a way that hadn't struck me before was the kind of layout. And the fact that we had the boss, that very typical, you know, like you say, you can see it in an airport terminal, you can see it back home in the UK, in the States.
So a little boutique right in there, in the wall.
The boutique was just opposite. Mm-hmm. So you had Boss, the shop.
Oh, and then the island.
The little island, yeah. Right in the middle there. That wasn't a demonstrator, it wasn't a different kind of store, but it was Boss itself.
I think they were fragrance, though. They were all fragrance.
That's right. But they were using the fragrance then to pull people in, because they were doing the demonstrations, they got the service people out there. So I think they were doing a number of things. They were using the service people in the same way that we've talked about before in the hypermarket.
Well, I think this is a trend that we've seen over time. You know, when I was younger, a long time ago, we didn't see a lot of that.
You don't pull that gray hair.
we can see you get this co-branding basically going on. And then a lot more of that these days. And then, of course, these days you have a lot of your brands moving into different product lines. So Christian Dior moves not just in fragrance, but then goes into other products, sunglasses and fashions. And now you got your fashions come into fragrance.
Sure, yes.
And so it's perfect. You put the fragrance island out there. People stop to get a tester or something like this to test it out, talk to the person. And then right there is the store. So you get that synergy. Yeah, that is a little bit different. I haven't seen that a whole lot in the U.S. I guess you haven't seen it in the U.K. that much,
James. I haven't seen it in the U.K. Like we're talking about here. And as you say, I think there's that element of the range of products, but using them in that way that engages the customer, offers the opportunity for some amount of dialogue. And I think also importantly that for these big Western brand stores, it's quite imposing actually to walk in. You've got these sales staff glaring at you wherever you are in the world, kind of checking you out whether you're really going to buy something or whether you're just speculative. And this kind of softens that and makes it a little bit more Asian, which has that emphasis on relationship and friendship and making a place friendly. And I think it offers the formality of the brand plus a friendly edge to it. And I think that kind of for the first time struck me in the way that they'd done that. And we saw the Boss. And then further down there are several others, kind of similar pattern. The inside formal store plus that little outside kind of island.
And which one? I think it was Boss. They were co-branding with Ferrari.
Yeah.
They had all red stands.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
So a lot of co-branding going on there.
Which was interesting. And then just behind us, they had the Zegna stand as well.
Yeah.
And right down at the end, they had another one that, again, paired up in a similar way. And I think there were some that were independent. The Dior store as well, that was completely temporary.
I didn't even see the Dior store.
That was the one right under the dome that was temporary promotion.
Well, that was Clinique.
That was Clinique,
yeah.
Was it?
Okay. Yes, I didn't see Dior at all. And I got to check this out, why Dior wasn't there. I was looking for them. I have a special invested interest in that, as you know.
Yeah.
So, I only use Eau Sauvage.
Yeah,
now, big Eau Sauvage
now, fan. Now I know why, yes. Because you're not a guy to splash on that kind of well.
Well, I got used to it, and I just really like it. It's you can't find it in the U.S. anymore.
Can you not?
Au Sauvage. No, they want to push some other junky stuff. Anyway, off topic there. But, so that co-branding and that island, moving one type of product out there to get attention, maybe draw people in more in the relationship. And the Clinique promotion was huge. So that's something interesting, too. I think that the mall's designed in a way. It's got that big dome in it.
Yeah.
And then under that dome is a huge open space, obviously made for activities. Oh. Now, of course, a lot of U.S. malls have some area of activity, but you rarely see a really dedicated, open, round area
and
for
activity. And a focal kind of point.
Very much focal. And Clinique's a promotion was huge, really big. They must have like at least 50 to 60 employees running around there. They had a line of girls just standing out in front. The PA system blasting all the time.
I think, as you say, you have that big open space, you know, the typical marble and these kind of elements. But then when we went down to the basement, those similar kind of elements that we see outside. But that little...
It suddenly got crowded.
It got crowded.
Very narrow aisles.
Food that was available and lots of promotional stands and right into that little sort of hypermarket there and all the things that we've talked about elsewhere come back in there. So no food upstairs. But the moment you want a snack, you want your ice cream, you want even something a bit more substantial, straight down to the basement.
Down to the basement. Of course, the actual restaurants were up on the top. They were the top two floors, all real restaurants.
They're the nice end. They're clearly, when we looked in, you could see the people. It's kind of a fairly formal setting. You're spending a reasonable amount of money in there. Whereas the bottom, you know, it was the snack end of the market.
Another thing that's interesting, I hope we can get some pictures. I'm not sure if the camera was functioning at the time or if I took some photos or not. But the very top floor, they had up there Sony... I think Yamaha pianos were up there, was it?
And
there was some
very high-end
flat-screen TVs.
Hi-fi.
But did you notice it was really kind of dumpy up there?
Yes.
Not very well-maintained, not very organized. There were some home appliances up there. All of a sudden, we got up that last couple floors. It kind of fell apart that way. So I wonder if the rent's much lower. There was a magic shop. Now, to support a magic shop, I can't imagine that rent's very high at all. Remember that guy tried to give you a magic card?
I remember, and I remember them walking onto the bookstore that just, like you say...
And there was a bookstore. No, Taiwan bookstores, right. Taiwan, in the Japanese-influenced malls in Japan and in Taiwan, you can have bookstores usually up at the top. Mm-hmm. And they're really high-end bookstores. There's one in Taichung. I think it's inside the Sogo. Multiple levels inside, walkways that go around these huge round areas. It looks like a kind of cathedral feeling to it, right? But this was just a store with a glass window, nothing interior decoration at all. So I'm guessing the rent there is low, which tells me something, James. It tells me that although you've got that really high end there, it's not a massive number of audience for that. And so you still want to draw people in there. And so you've got your alternatives. It wasn't a discount thing. Now, in Japan and in Taiwan, you've got your discount floor. You've got your whole discount floor. I didn't see a discount floor here.
You know, to sort of build on that point, I think that, as you say, there wasn't a lot of discount, and really wasn't any discount that I could see. But the thing that surprised me was really the way you had that density of brands there. I mean, we were looking at not a massive mall. You could get around it pretty quickly. But every level had all the brands, basically. But in concentrated, very, very concentrated. So I think that was, you clearly looked like that was the place of choice where you went if you said, you know, I want a branded thing or I want to be seen in that space. And the rest is kind of squeezed out, basically. So I can really guess that there's probably two or three places. I know the Mitsukoshi is here as well. And these must be two or three places that you go, and it just has that real deep concentration of those kind of branded elements, and I guess...
Well, I do think it's more concentrated. What I see, like in the Mitsukoshi that's in Taichung, your first couple floors are like that, and then the rest spread out more. This is, the whole thing was that way.
That's right, exactly. I remember you and I, as we walked around, we said, hey, where's the discount floor? And we were looking for that element, and B2 offered something, or B1, B2 offered that kind of thing, but... The density was so strong, and that made me really feel that there was, that was the place you went. And then outside that, you got those other elements.
Well, we took that photo from the upstairs looking down. It was like a beehive.
Yes.
And every floor was just packed with those brands in there. You never really walk into a kind of open floor area where you just have men's clothes or something like this in a wide variety with the brands mixed up like you do in a Mizukoshi kind of department store. Mm. It was all highly branded little tiny stores. So I think what this tells me is I think what we're talking about here in Shanghai is really a very high-end, targeted market. And yeah, Calvin Klein may be selling some, but they're not reaching a wide audience. It's very narrow. In fact, it may be a lot of international people, international Chinese even, that are come back and are opening up factories or doing work here, or people from other parts of China who set down a house or something here.
I think you're right. I was trying to suppress some laughter there because I was thinking that you could add another segment on there. This is more of a joke than anything, a curious segment. And I was thinking of that model that we saw in Calvin Klein. But
I did get a picture of it. Hopefully we can get a still on the site. And that was the Calvin Klein store, which was black. The motif was black. Yeah. Almost completely empty store. Yeah. A few clothes hanging on the rack. A couple anorexic people on the pictures of anorexic people on the window. And then in the middle of the store was a big block. Looked like just a big black. Looks like something out of 2001 Space Odyssey. A block that's the size of a table. And a model lying on it. A plastic model with no head. And the legs spread open. I guess with Calvin Klein clothes on, I suppose. And I saw a lady go in there, a Chinese lady walked in, looked around the model, circled around a bit, curious, and then ducked right down and looked between the legs.
it's interesting from two points of view. I think that it really reflects that curiosity you see, isn't it? And Chinese people have no fear about demonstrating that curiosity, and that's a good... I mean, it's a wild example, but it's just so true.
Well, I wonder if that's a standard thing he's doing, or if that's just in Shanghai, they just do that to provoke people.
I'm sure it's standard.
Yeah. Oh, okay, Calvin Klein, he just does that everywhere, right?
Yes.
In your face.
In your face, quite literally. And then the other thing I think that is so amazing, as you say, you have that typical format where few objects on sale, but I mean, absolute prime time real estate.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was surprised that upstairs you didn't really have it so fancy. So I'm kind of thinking, you know, there's a limit. They're not drawing, you know, they're not filling up the whole store with the real high end stuff. And kind of, as you go up, it kind of ran out of steam. Anyway, it's a very interesting. So, this is the high end of Shanghai. If you come here as a tourist, if you work here and you're being put up by your company, this is the kind of place you go shopping. You feel right at home. If you like airport shopping, you'll have no trouble at all. We saw some figures. Of course, James and I were involved in some conferences going on here. We saw some figures for income. And it looks like your top-end income people are from... I think the survey was from 9 different cities, James. And the high-end, what she labeled as upper class, the real upper class, we're talking about 24,000 renminbi a year and up. And that's less than 10% of the market. And the big part of the market, 23% plus 27%, this would be about 50%. Half of the market is in the range of 9,000 renminbi up to about 24,000 renminbi.
We should turn that into dollars. So.
Okay, well, let me see. The high end then would be 24,000. That's about 70,000-80,000 NT. So we're talking about 3,000. US dollars a year.
Yeah, and we have to keep reminding ourselves that's a year, basically.
That is labeled by this researcher the upper middle class. And she emphasized something very important from her research. She was saying that from their study, the income distribution is strongly pyramid in shape, not diamond. You just lose the whole, you know, the bottom part, just the middle part is not there. It just comes down and then that's it. Very, very pyramidal in structure. And so, you know, you have to wonder how far that can really go. And James, you and I have been staying kind of outside the central district, although we're still in the city, and you can just see that retailing everywhere. We have a couple videos of that walking around.
We've got you can see the bulk of this income group, and we've obviously, you know, connected up with that kind of end of the retailing spectrum, which is interesting. Another aspect of the retailing environment that's interesting here is still the predominance of, or the large number of, government owned and run stores. And we were riding one of those yesterday, looking at clothing, and they're run by people who are paid by the government, so there's no sort of marketing glitz.
Was there any bargaining allowed? We got your shoes there, right? You got your shoes with your wife.
No, it's a flat rate price.
No bargaining.
They're typically no bargaining. And the old guys there, she asked them, is this a private store or a government store? No, look at us, we're old men, you know, we're just waiting for the retirement. We work for the government. And
probably one of our listeners will correct us on this, but yeah, that seemed like the way it was worked. You got a good deal on your shoes, they were nice.
But for sure, they're government run. We went to another store, in fact, that evening, that's why we went yesterday evening, because you could buy fabric.
You found that downtown? That was all the way downtown by the river?
Yeah, near the river, there's fabric, old. In fact, it's one of the old, what used to be the department stores we went into. Very old, typical kind of fading yellow paint now, cool. Fading kind of glamour. And Winston Taylor there, and these guys are sort of slow, and but you know the fabric they're going to offer, there's no incentive to give you junk, because basically they're working for the government, so they show you the price of the fabric, and then the tailoring price is very moderate. 5 o'clock comes, the lights are clicking off. You better be out of there. You know? Capitalism hasn't touched that bit of the department store
world.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we've been in these kind of department stores previously. In Beijing has them, kind of older ones. They look a little bit Soviet-style construction.
Exactly,
you know?
Yes. You tune right into it. And exactly that. And I mean,
I think this would be kind of your upper middle class people. That's where they're going.
Indeed, exactly. Because when we were there, a whole lot of suits being made, nicely done, nice tailoring, and clearly a lot of business people were going in there and getting product. And
local business people, local, as opposed to the department store, where you're going to get a lot of your international business people or your really hedonistic consumption.
Indeed, yes, they sort of, and these guys are clearly part of the reason. When we talk to some of those guys, they like to go over there. Is you're safe, you know what product you're getting, you're not getting ripped off, you're not getting someone pulling over on you, telling you it's a nice wool or it's cashmere when actually it's plastic kind of thing. So, very interesting experience. We're going back there tomorrow, so
great.
Have to take the consumer cam. When we went to pay for some fabric, it just illustrated what we're talking about. Because what did the lady do? She added up the price. How did she do it? No pen, abacus.
Yeah, abacus, yeah.
Well, and what was right beside the abacus? PC.
Use the abacus before you use the PC.
I said, can I take a photo? She said, sure.
Oh, she let you take a shot.
Yeah,
that's good.
And then she was doing the abacus, adding up. And I said, wow, that was so quick, you know, the McQuay. No, that's slow.
That's my slow mode. Well, we got to put that picture on the website then. That's great.
Must. It was, very interesting experience, because my wife, who came here, over 10 years ago now, said the contrast, even in those stores, is interesting. In that, the service isn't super smooth, it works, sort of goes on. But 10 years ago, she said, they'll talk for 20 minutes, and then they'll ask them something, and they'll say, you need to go over there, and then they'll carry on talking. So at least that sense of service has sort of started to move into even those kind of stores.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, well, they got to compete, right? So yeah, this is interesting. This is our look at something we don't look at very often, but this is our look at department stores in Shanghai.
Right.
We have another show where we're going to look at department stores in Taiwan and go shopping around there and look at what's similar. I think we're going to find basically the same airport concourse style, or what we call the globalization of nothing, right? That's not actually what we call it. That's Ritzer, I think. Globalization of nothing. Okay, James, so that's our coffee's all gone. We're ready to head off to another social event.
Well, you're the social animal. My voice is going, so you better do the talking on this one.
Okay, we'll be back for another show. We'll give you some more information, a little bit more observation about Shanghai. We're going to be visiting some wet markets and doing some other exciting things, get some of the localization. So, see you around.
See you.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Oh.